Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions.
What does it mean to be American?
I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us for our series, Democracy Optimist. In this episode, the 23rd in our series, host Josh Douglas, a professor of election law and voting rights at the University of Kentucky, takes up President Trump's call for Republican-led states to redraw their congressional districts to protect a narrow GOP House majority, while Democrats in some states are trying to counteract that by doing their own redrawing of the maps. If the election's close, these redrawn maps could be the difference maker in determining who controls Congress. Here's Josh Douglas.
It's a perennial problem in the world of voting rights, redistricting and gerrymandering. Every 10 years after the census, states must redraw their lines for Congress, state legislature, and even city council to comply with the Supreme Court's mandate of one person, one vote. Every district must have roughly equal population. There are other rules as well, such as compliance with the Voting Rights Act. And disputes over these issues often last the entire decade. In 2025, the Supreme Court is hearing a major case out of Louisiana that could gut the protections of the Voting Rights Act when it comes to minority representation. But this year, disputes over redistricting have gone into overdrive as some states have engaged in what we call mid-decade redistricting or re-redistricting. These states drew the lines for congressional seats back in 2021, which are supposed to last for the entire decade. But spurred by President Trump, Texas redrew its map to turn five seats that were more favorable to Democrats into ones more winnable for Republicans. In response, California put a measure on the ballot to redraw its own maps to make five Republican-leaning districts into Democratic ones. It's a race to the bottom with partisan gerrymandering run rampant. And it could have a major impact on which party controls Congress after the 2026 midterm elections. Missouri is also part of the fight, redrawing its map to split up the Kansas City area into several districts, which will likely flip one seat from Democratic to Republican. Lawsuits have predictably ensued. Here to discuss that mid-decade redistricting in Missouri and the litigation over the map is Denise Lieberman. She is the director and general counsel of the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition, a nonpartisan organization that works to advance free, fair, and accessible elections in Missouri. She is also the faculty director of the Voter Access and Engagement Initiative at Washington University in St. Louis. Denise, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you for having me, Josh.
So let's first talk about the organization, Missouri Voter Protection Coalition. How did this come about and what's the sort of work that you all are doing?
Well, for the last 20 years, advocates in Missouri have been coming together to protect our freedom to vote, starting with a passage of a strict photo ID requirement in the state in 2006 that led to litigation and led to the groups continuing to come together. We have now formalized into a permanent nonprofit organization in the state of Missouri, focused on ensuring that voting is free, fair, and accessible to all Missourians, with particular focus on communities whose voices are underrepresented in our democracy and who shoulder disproportionate burdens of discriminatory laws, practices, and policies.
Okay, so that's great background in terms of kind of the organization. And of course, you're involved now in the mid-decade redistricting fight going on in Missouri. So give us your perspective. How did this all come about? And actually, maybe more importantly, why should the everyday voter be concerned about what's going on?
Well, Josh, while redistricting can feel like challenging subject to talk about, everyday voters should be concerned because this affects your ability to be heard and to be represented fairly. And that's why redistricting matters, because the way that lawmakers draw district lines can have a tremendous impact on your political power as a voter and whether you and your community will be able to elect candidates that you believe represent your interests.
So Missouri Governor Mike Kehoe said when he signed this new map that splits up part of the Kansas City area into several districts that it actually better represents Missouri residents. Is he wrong?
Josh, Governor Kehoe is quite wrong on this point. The gold standard about how we draw district lines is really about keeping communities together. We talk about ensuring that intact communities have the ability, have enough structure in the way that lines are drawn, that they can actually elect representatives who represent their interests. What you've seen here in Missouri is taking an intact community like Kansas City and slicing it into three different congressional districts, preventing people in Kansas City from acting on some core values that make Kansas City what it is and that make their interests shared with other Kansas Cityans. And worse, this particular map not only slices Kansas City into thirds, but it does so along racial lines and places some Kansas Cityans in the same congressional district as farmers all the way across the state on the Illinois and Iowa border. And while all of us may share some core values as Missourians, it's certainly not hard to see that rural communities in eastern Missouri are going to have very different interests that they want their members of Congress to look at than urban residents in Kansas City, Missouri.
Now, the racial component you mentioned is really interesting because of how all of these things interact and how the really various attacks on voting rights and fair representation are coming from different angles. So as I mentioned in my introduction, the Supreme Court is hearing, U.S. Supreme Court is hearing a case out of Louisiana about racial representation. And, you know, most people, most experts think that the court is likely to strike down a key part of the Voting Rights Act, which had required fairness along racial lines when drawing new maps. So do you think that the Missouri legislators drew this map? Obviously, they knew the racial dynamics that were going into it. Did they, assume that, well, the court's going to rule this way and so get this map in place when it's unlikely to be challenged, you know, the viability of a challenge under the Voting Rights Act is less likely?
Well, it's hard for me to surmise what the legislature's intent here is, because, in fact, lawmakers themselves didn't even have a hand in drafting this map. The bill sponsor himself admitted in committee hearings in both the House and the Senate that he wasn't able to answer questions about why lines were drawn in the way that they were drawn, and admitted he didn't understand the history of particularly Kansas City's African-American communities and some of the housing segregation that historically caused those committees to be racially segregated. Unfortunately, we are looking at the prospect of losing some key protections in the Voting Rights Act in the Khalid case that's coming up in front of the United States Supreme Court. But that doesn't make these maps any less problematic, and it doesn't make these maps any less violative of the core principles of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which are intended to ensure that the right to vote cannot be denied or abridged on account of race. And that's exactly what these new maps in Missouri do. By cutting through a key location in Kansas City, a street called Troost, which is an 11-mile stretch of road in Kansas City that is, United States Congressman Emanuel Cleaver testified to the legislature, is basically Kansas City's Mason-Dixon line. And that's because, Josh, prior to passage of the Fair Housing Act, it was illegal for African Americans to live west of Troost. And so the legacy of that housing segregation is precisely why these district lines and where they are to cut makes a really, really big difference in the ability of Kansas Cityans of color and Missourians of color to be able to elect candidates of choice. These lines were drawn precisely to eliminate that. You've got Kansas Cityans who have for 11 terms reelected an 11-term congressman, the former mayor of Kansas City, the former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. And that's who they targeted in order to strip him of his post.
So let's get into the weeds a little bit, because I think this stuff, as an election law professor, I think this stuff is so important for everyday voters to understand. And one of the things that's really interesting about the mid-decade redistricting that occurred in Missouri, in Texas, and the other states that are considering it is the potential violation of the one-person, one-vote idea. So one of the requirements anytime a legislature draws maps is it means that every district has to be roughly the same population. Each district has the same number of people. That way it takes the same number of people to elect a representative from Congress in District 1 as it does in District 2. Of course, populations changed throughout the decade. So it's a little bit of a fiction that it's absolutely equal in every election. It's not, but at least we start out with population equality. But here, Missouri used data from 2021, the census data from 2021, to redraw lines in 2025. How should we think about those equal population principles?
That's a great question, Josh, and really highlights the problem with mid-decade redistricting, and makes clear that this was nothing but a political ploy to put their finger on the scale before a single vote is even cast in 2026. And they weren't even really obtuse about that intent. The key here is that we draw district lines to ensure, as you mentioned, that districts are roughly the same size. And how do we know that? Well, we get new data every 10 years from the U.S. Census that occurs every 10 years. And in fact, Missouri's Constitution also makes clear that lawmakers cannot recalibrate district lines without that data. In this case, no new data was provided to the state about shifting populations, even though we know that areas like Kansas City have seen a surge in population growth. Kansas City is a cool town and lots of people are moving there. Yet we won't have that population data until the next census in 2030 that could actually end up giving Kansas City more representation, not less, like lawmakers did with these rigged maps.
We're talking with Denise Lieberman of the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition, and just mentioned how Kansas City is a cool city and people are moving there. I can attest to that. I visited not too long ago and was really impressed with the revitalization of the downtown as compared to about a decade or so before the last time I had been there. You also mentioned the Missouri Constitution, and that brings up the lawsuits. So this map was passed. The governor signed it after pressure from President Trump to lots of Republican-controlled states to change the maps in an effort to try to ensure the Republicans win the midterms in 2026, and then Democratic states are doing this in response. Let's talk about the lawsuits in Missouri against this mid-decade redistricting. Walk us through some of the arguments in these cases.
Absolutely. There have been four lawsuits filed. I am counsel on one of those lawsuits challenging the constitutionality of mid-decade redistricting.
In other words, under the state constitution, right? Which,
yes,
I think is a really important point.
Yes, and that goes to your point about some of the challenges of bringing voting rights cases in federal court right now. In particular, here in Missouri, which is in a federal circuit called the Eighth Circuit, there are several cases where justices in the Eighth Circuit and federal court have found that voters themselves and their organizations that speak for them don't have standing to even bring claims that district lines violate the Voting Rights Act. Now, that's been stayed by the United States Supreme Court, and that's another issue that we're likely to see hit the United States Supreme Court this year. but it means that the courthouse doors are really closed to voters in states like Missouri to bring claims in federal court under the Voting Rights Act. And so we look to our state constitution, which actually includes provisions that provide stronger protection for voting rights than the federal constitution does. In particular, here, our state constitution sets up when district lines can be redrawn. And the language is clear that only when new census data is certified to the governor can lawmakers redraw those district lines. And that's in keeping with the core principle of ensuring that districts are around the same size, one person, one vote. And that's the basis on which my organization and several co-counsel have brought suit challenging these lines. But there are several other suits as well that also challenge the way that the maps were drawn, breaking up intact communities like Kansas City and arguing that these intact communities are being divided, that this map is not compact. Another core principle in drawing district lines is that you want districts to be relatively compact, that you are keeping people who live near each other in the same district, right? People who are in communities are part of the same district. Here you've got a congressional districts that span from Western Missouri all the way to Eastern Missouri and cover very widely differing swaths of populations in our state. That is most certainly not compact. And another lawsuit has also been filed arguing that the governor lacked the authority to call this special session in the first place, and that therefore anything that the legislature did in that session should be null and void. Calling legislators back into session after they've already adjourned is something that governors can do. But here in Missouri, the law makes very clear that that should happen only in extraordinary circumstances. For example, many folks know that the city of St. Louis, where I live, was hit with a very, very treacherous tornado in May that wiped out thousands of homes and left thousands of people without housing. The governor called legislators back into session for a special session in June so that they could allocate funding for tornado relief. That's an example of an extraordinary circumstance that can't wait till the legislature reconvenes in January. Here, there was no such emergency other than a political ask by President Trump to curry political favor.
So let's talk a little bit more about the lawsuit that you said you're bringing with respect to the timing of redistricting and the fact that the Missouri Constitution says you can only redraw the maps after you get the census data. And Missouri got that census data in 2021 and then drew the maps then. And so it's doing it again in 2025. There's the Missouri Supreme Court case from decades ago that says you can't draw the maps a second time, right? So shouldn't this be a pretty easy case?
You would think so. And we think that the Constitution is quite clear here that in stating that once that census data is certified, that's when the redistricting happens. And that has occurred already, as you mentioned. Lawmakers got the 2020 census data in early 2021, and they redrew those maps and approved them in 2022. So they already got that shot at the apple. They don't get a redo in 2025, particularly when lawmakers did get that census data in 2021. They rejected the very kind of map that lawmakers pushed through this special legislative session. And the only reason they were able to push it through, by the way, is by suspending the normal rules of conduct in the legislature, not allowing other legislators to even stand up and voice concerns or objections to how it was going forward.
Now, do you think judges, especially elected judges or judges at least that go before the voters for retention, however many years periodically, are they competent to render this kind of decision, or is it just going to look political to them as well.
Well, I think there's no doubt that this is nothing but a political theater happening here. And even the legislative sponsors wouldn't deny that. However, Missouri judges are put into place through what's called a nonpartisan court plan. And I would suggest that's one of the shining jewels of Missouri. A lot of folks don't realize, for example, that Missouri's constitution includes a fundamental right to vote, as you and I have discussed in the past. And a lot of people also don't know that our judges don't go through partisan elections like they do in other states. They are actually selected by a nonpartisan panel who assess their qualifications and recommend qualified judges to the governor. Now, the governor does have the final say in appointing those justices, but at least they have gone through a nonpartisan vetting process. Either way, Josh, this case is going to land at the Missouri Supreme Court, and that's who will have the final say on what Missouri's constitution requires. We are confident going in that the constitution is quite clear that these kinds of political antics are not acceptable under the Missouri constitution, and for good reason, because without new census data, the only thing driving mid-decade redistricting then is political gerrymandering.
Now, in addition to the lawsuits, there's a movement on the ground for a ballot initiative to have the voters reject this. Give us a sense of what's going on the ground in a way that demonstrates this does affect everyday people.
It really affects everyday people, Josh. You know, as we were the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition anchors the policy and legislative advocacy in Missouri on the right to vote. And once the special session was called, voters across Missouri expressed their firm displeasure. We called people to come to the Capitol in the middle of September, and we got 5,000 people to come to the Missouri Capitol to express their displeasure. In House and Senate legislative hearings, over 4,000 people submitted testimony opposing these measures and came to Jefferson City, Missouri, to express their displeasure with these activities. And in each of these cases, virtually no one stood up and expressed support for these rigged maps. In fact, in the Missouri Senate, there was not a single witness who testified in favor of the maps. And so Missouri law provides for a citizen's ability to repeal legislation that's passed by the Missouri legislature. So the Missouri legislature passed these maps as a piece of legislation, and Missourians have 90 days to request that the voters consider repealing any piece of legislation that the legislature proposes. So in this case, Missouri citizens, as soon as legislators passed this map, began collecting signatures to place a repeal on the ballot. They have to collect signatures representing 5% of registered voters in 6 out of 8 Missouri's congressional districts, which means they have to collect over 117,000 signatures by early December in order to place this on the ballot. But given the widespread displeasure and discontent of this action amongst Missouri voters, this repeal is well on its way to getting on the ballot before Missouri voters, who we're confident will repeal this highly partisan and gerrymandered map offered by the Missouri's legislature.
And I often say on this show, democracy depends on we the people taking hold of it. And that's why I still, even given the some of the struggles we face, remain optimistic about the prospect for sustaining democracy if and only if we the people stay engaged. Denise Lieberman is the director and general counsel of the Missouri Voter Protection Coalition, which you can find at movpc.org. Denise, thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Josh, that was a really interesting conversation you just had with Denise Lieberman. I know that you're writing an article on this very subject. Tell us a little bit about that. Give us a preview.
So many people don't realize that state constitutions have really robust rights that protect individuals. And this is a great example where we're not going to see the federal courts step in to prohibit a mid-decade redistricting done for partisan reasons. And that's because in 2019, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a very important decision called Rucho versus Common Cause, in which the court said, we're staying out of partisan gerrymandering. Partisan gerrymandering is not the sort of thing that federal judges are competent to hear. Federal judges can't decide when politics has gone too far in drawing district lines. And there was a vigorous dissent in that case, but that is the rule from the U.S. Supreme Court. But the other thing the court said was that state courts might be an avenue to bring claims against partisan gerrymandering. And so what I thought was really interesting from our conversation with Denise, and it goes to the scholarship you mentioned, is I'm writing some new scholarship about how state courts should think about mid-decade redistricting. And the basic argument is that anytime a legislature draws a map in the middle of a decade, after they've already done it once, the court should adopt a presumption of unlawful partisanship. That is to say, the state constitution protects the people from the legislature taking a second bite at the apple when the only reason they're doing it is to try to gain some political advantage. Now, a presumption of partisan advantage does mean the state could say, look, we have a legitimate reason for redrawing the map. Think of a natural disaster that displaces a lot of people. Maybe the state wants to try to get back to equality in the districts when they know a ton of people have moved. But absent some real meaningful justification that's not political, my argument is that state courts should use their state constitutions and the more robust protection for voters in their state constitutions. And all states have these, by the way. State courts should use those state constitutional protections to strike down a mid-decade map unless the state has a very solid non-political reason for doing so.
Coming up after the break, the experience of arriving in Frankfurt as a first-term Democrat and a member of a tiny minority. I'm Tom Martin with Josh Douglas, and you're listening to Episode 23 of the Eastern Standard Series Democracy Optimist on WEKU.
When you support WEKU, you are making it possible to produce programs like Eastern Standard, focusing on Central and Eastern Kentucky, what the regions share in common, and what makes each distinctive. Featuring interviews by host and editor Tom Martin and a growing roster of contributors, Eastern Standard is professionally produced by sound designer and technical director Neil Kesterson. This weekly current affairs program is made possible by your support of WEKU. You can join our community of supporters by calling 800-621-8890 or contributing online at weku.org. The WEKU Daily News Podcast is now available for download. It's available weekday afternoons and includes the top five stories of the day. The WEKU News Podcast is available on the WEKU app, Apple, Spotify, and WEKU.org.
You're listening to Episode 23 of the Eastern Standard Series Democracy Optimist on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin with series host Josh Douglas. What's it like in 2025 to win election to the state legislature and find yourself there in the state capitol in Frankfurt representing the needs and expectations of the people back home? Here's Josh Douglas with a guest who's just been through that experience.
Democracy is about representation. Elected officials should fairly represent the interests of their constituents. But what causes someone to run in the first place? What is it like when they first take office? And how does it feel when you enter the halls of government, especially in the minority party? Here to give us an inside view of how democracy and representation actually works is Ann Donworth, who represents the 76th District in the Kentucky House of Representatives. That's the district that covers much of Lexington. So I am one of Ann's constituents, and now I get to put her in the hot seat. Representative Donworth, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So we first met when you were not a representative, but were the director of development for the Lexington Public Library. Seems like a pretty good job. So why'd you decide to run for office?
That's the weird thing about fundraising. You get involved with a lot of weird things that you never thought you would. One of the things for me was that the library had a few pieces of legislation that were going to cut public funding for our public library system. So we couldn't use public dollars to fight it in the state legislature. So I, through the Library Foundation, ended up being the registered employer of a lobbyist and started going to Frankfurt. And I think that's really what happens when you start paying attention to what's going on in Frankfurt and you see other things that are going on that you wish you could engage on those topics. You start paying more attention and eventually that's what kind of what drove me to run.
Yeah. So you actually were kind of, this is almost a call to duty in that you saw what was happening and thought you had a voice that you might be able to lend.
Exactly. So it's been a learning experience, but that's life.
Yeah. And well, and you know, it's interesting to hear that a lot of people think about politics should be this kind of idealistic notion. But what you're saying is that in many ways you did embody that, that you heard things and you said, you know, why isn't my voice here as well?
Exactly. And then when the seat that I now occupy was held by a woman named Ruth M. Palumbo, who was there for a very long time. And when she announced her retirement, it was, I mean, for me, it was really important that we have a woman. Mm-hmm. It was really important that we have a parent. And I know we'll get into that a little bit later on. I wanted somebody who would be able to fight for us as well.
Sure. So let's talk about the campaign. You decided to run. You're going door to door in spring of 2024. What were you hearing from voters? What were they talking about?
So that was a lot of what people were talking about were abortion and women's health care, mm-hmm. women's reproductive care specifically, housing, both affordability and affordable housing. So you have affordable housing, which is targeted for low income, income restricted, to have that capital A affordable housing, but also affordability for general housing and how can people be able to find good quality houses. Also heard, you know, gun safety is one of those things that comes up in spurts mm-hmm. when something terrible happens and then people are very upset about it. There were a few incidences last spring, so I did hear quite a bit about that. That was one of the things that was really important for me as well. Mm-hmm. But that was certainly for the Democratic voters in our district, that was something that was really important.
And so a lot of bread and butter issues, you know, not pie in the sky, democracy, you know, the 2024 presidential election, a lot of that was, at least on the Democratic side, you know, was about democracy. But you weren't hearing that from people. You were hearing about kind of these bread and butter concerns.
No. And also in 2024, we were also hearing so much about education because of Amendment 2 being on the ballot. Democracy is kind of this abstract, beautiful thing, but that is not what is on when you go into the voting booth. You're thinking about the price of eggs. Mm-hmm. You're thinking about, can I get the prescription that my doctor just wrote it? Can I afford it? So those are not the kitchen table issues that people have in mind when they're going in to vote.
Sure. So you won the primary, close election. And ran unopposed in the general election. So basically winning the primary in May 2024 won you the seat, although obviously you needed at least a few people to vote in November to make sure you won the general. When did the planning to start, to take office start? Right after May when you won? I mean, what sort of things were you doing throughout 2024 to get ready to take office?
So I had a little bit of extra time. Most people, when they come in, they don't know that they're going to win until after November. So I used that time. I went to a lot of the interim committee meetings in Frankfurt to learn about the issues that the legislature was looking into and doing more research into it, just so that I could get a feel for the process, but also for the issues that were going to be coming up. I met with most, not quite all, but most of the committee chairs, because I wanted to be able to build relationships as much as I could, but also learn about the types of issues that would come before each individual committee, My standard questions for all of them were, what are you the most proud of in the last couple of years, and what do you think is coming in the next 5 years?
Mm-hmm.
But to try to build relationships, because so much of it is relationship-based. Locally, I didn't change a whole lot about what I was doing in the community. I was still going to all the community events that I always loved and supported. I wasn't fundraising or knocking doors or doing the advertisements the same way that I had been, but still trying to be present and understanding what's going on and trying to meet also with local and federal officials so that we could be able to work together for the people of Lexington.
So you go to Frankfurt in January of this year to actually officially take your oath and take the seat. Tell us about that first day in Frankfurt, or maybe leading up to that. But I know there's a new member orientation. You know, did someone show you around to, like, say, like, here's how you get through the tunnels that go between the annex of the Capitol and the actual floor of the House?
So thankfully, we had 2 days of orientation in December, because the day that was scheduled in January was the day before the inauguration day. And that was a major snow day.
Mm-hmm.
So the Capitol was closed and we didn't have that third day of orientation.
Mm-hmm.
But we had our badges made so that we could access the tunnels. Parking permits we actually didn't get until the first day of session.
Did you park with the masses for the first day?
No, we parked on the legislator floor, but then we got little notes from security saying, you're not supposed to park here. We had to say, no, I was. But we didn't have time with our legislative aides. One of the things that people don't realize, there isn't a staff for each member of the General Assembly. You have one aide that will serve three or four different legislators. I'm lucky my aide only works with one other person,
mm-hmm.
but I really hadn't met her going into it. Didn't know which office I was going to be in until the day I got there. And it's just kind of a surreal feeling.
Hmm. And did someone at least show you around a little bit and, you know, tell you how to swipe in and how to, you know, which tunnels took you where? Or were you just wandering around kind of figuring it out?
I knew from my time in Frankfurt, I don't think there was anything. I think it just was we each within our caucus were assigned a mentor. And my mentor probably would have offered that, but I didn't need it.
Mm-hmm. So to walk us through that very first day on the floor itself, what was that like when you're now on the floor of the Kentucky House of Representatives as a member of the General Assembly?
You just look up and think, wow, I can't believe I'm here. I can't believe I'm actually doing this.
Your kids were with you that day?
My kids and my mom were there with me and one of my really good friends. And, you know, we have the formal swearing-in ceremony, and obviously listeners can't hear this, but I was shaking from head to toe.
Hmm. And what did you think right after? Like, right after you got sworn in, what was going through your head, if you can even remember?
Probably things I shouldn't say or I can't say on the air. A lot of excitement, a lot of disbelief and honor. You know, to be able to sit in those halls. I mean, our state capitol is a really beautiful, amazing place, and you feel that when you walk on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
So just feeling that legacy of what's happened there and knowing that I get to be a part of helping shape what comes for future generations. Go ahead.
What are you going to add to that?
Well, I was going to add, after the swearing in, where we all swear in together, then it's straight down to business. We started right into the rules conversation. So there's not really much easing the way in.
Hmm. Interesting. So what's something about being a state legislator that most people don't know, or maybe some fun perks, some hidden frustrations?
Fun perks, which are also a frustration, you are given the opportunity to buy a lot of things. So,
such as what?
Such as basketball tickets, UK and U of L, a box at the Derby, And the Oaks. And so, but you're still paying for them.
Mm-hmm.
You just have the access. And if you bought all of these things, I'm pretty sure that would take up your entire salary for the year. And I think people expect your state level leaders to have a campaign slush fund. We don't. It's most of what we are doing are coming out of our own pockets.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just different than what I had expected. And so you kind of pick and choose what you want to do and what you can do. And you try to do as many things as you possibly can and be as present as you can be.
Mm-hmm. So you're a Democrat. And there are 100 seats in the Kentucky House, and 20 are held by Democrats, 80 by Republicans. So what's it like to be not only in the minority party, but in the super minority party?
That is actually what I tell people is the biggest surprise about Frankfort, coming from Lexington,
mm-hmm.
where we are nonpartisan. I think people don't understand how partisan politics work. With an 80-20 supermajority, the majority party literally doesn't have to listen to the minority. They've got the votes for whatever they want to pass. So we don't have much opportunity to negotiate behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
I typically say if something goes to committee or comes up onto the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate, it's already going to pass. They already know they have the votes. That's usually when we get the materials as a super minority, and it's too late at that mm-hmm. point. So all we can do is talk to the people. And that's actually what I did fairly regularly on the floor. Nobody in the chamber is going to listen to my opposition on House Bill 4, which is the one that removed diversity, equity, inclusion from our higher education systems. At that point, you just have to talk to the public and tell people that you support them. And there's not anything else you can do in that situation.
Did being in that position make you lose a little bit of faith in terms of the project of democracy? You're speaking to the people, but, you know, maybe your constituents voted for you, but so many people in Kentucky voted for the other party. Do you have that sense of like, well, why even bother?
I actually have the opposite. I have the fight rather than the flight.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, we all have different political ideologies. Not all Democrats believe the exact same thing either. We're all somewhere on a spectrum. So for good public policy, in my opinion, it has to be something that both sides can live with. And that negotiation and finding the middle ground, that's where good public policy comes. And when you have a supermajority where there isn't that need to work together, you don't have that. And mm-hmm. so for me, I am all about how do we pick up more seats on the Democratic side, even independents. We don't have any independents in the state legislature right now. But I think that is the only way that we are going to have a more lowercase d Democratic Commonwealth right now.
We're speaking with Ann Donworth, who is a member of the Kentucky House of Representatives, representing a district in Lexington, Kentucky. Let's talk about some of those behind-the-scenes conversations. You know, you said that not being in the majority, but being actually in the super minority makes it hard for those for the Republicans currently to even need to reach out to Democrats to get the votes. But are there any examples where you were surprised by some bipartisanship activity happening in Frankfort?
Yes, and that's where it comes down to relationships on many levels. One of my colleagues here in Lexington, Representative Chad All, was able to work with a Republican who took Chad's bill. They worked together. It was Representative Kevin Jackson, who's a Republican legislator, and they co-sponsored a bill that did pass.
Mm-hmm.
Adriel Camuel had one of her bills that one of the Republicans actually took the bill without talking to her and added it into another one. So her legislation did pass as part of a package. Without credit for her. So there are examples of that. Representative Adam Moore actually got a bill. He's a freshman with me as well out of Lexington and Jessamine County. He had a bill that passed the House but not the Senate to cap the price of EpiPens.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a few bright spots, but when you're passing hundreds of pieces of legislation and just a handful of them are from Democratic legislators. It can be frustrating. There's not a whole lot of bipartisanship.
So you alluded to this also, but one of the most frustrating things for me as a scholar of democracy and election rules is the legislative process known as the committee substitute or committee sub. And I'm not aware of other states that do it to this extreme like Kentucky does, where you have a bill introduced, there's a committee hearing set, and moments before the committee convenes, a substitute bill is disseminated, known as the committee sub, and it could be completely different from what the initial published bill was. I remember once I went to go testify about a bill on voting, and the committee sub actually was given a copy of it early, but other people who were there to testify, some organizations, were asked to speak about a bill they had not yet read. How is this a thing? And you know, if democracy is about accountability and transparency, how do we get rid of this?
Yeah, I think in theory, what's supposed to happen with a committee substitute is it's supposed to be a small amendment. Instead, just a small change to make something better. You change a word. What happens too often is that it becomes a last-minute substitution where no one from the public has vetted it. Oftentimes, no one from the minority has vetted it either. We had one that came as a floor amendment, actually. In the waning hours, we had several that came as floor amendments in waning hours of the session this year. One went from, I think it was 7 pages, and then had a committee sub that took it to 40 pages. And then when it came up on the House floor, had another one that took it to 140 pages. And in the media was complaining about no one's seen this bill. And I'm sitting here as a legislator like, I didn't see it until it popped up on the screen in front of me.
And you question whether the people who voted for it had actually read it or not.
I mean,
as well.
I
right. 140 pages that just came out. Surely some of them had, but you
I'm sure some of them had, but I doubt all.
Yeah.
So it's frustrating on all sides. And what we often heard from the majority or from – well, actually only from the majority, but the majority people who had been there for a long time saying it was so much worse when the Democrats were in power. You have no idea. It was so much worse. And I realize I'm a freshman legislator and I'm naive and blissfully so, but just because one side did it wrong doesn't make it right. And so for me, my response to that is, well, and look what that did them. So you should learn your lesson from what happened to the Democrats who were in power 20 years ago. Practice good governance. And you are here to represent the people. We are here to represent the people. So we've got to make sure that we can actually hear their voices.
Let's talk about voting policy specifically. You won your seat in a close primary last May, but it was extremely low turnout, right? I think it was in the teens in terms of the turnout. So do we really have a representative democracy when so few people show up? When, you know, it was, I think, less than 15% turnout and you won a very close race, and then that ultimately gave, you know, you winning the seat. Is that how representative democracy should be?
It's not. And statewide, I think it was about a 12% average. Ours was the highest in the state, and I think it was 18%.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just really sad.
So how do we fix it?
I would love to say that open primaries are a way to do it, but I don't know, because even that's across both parties and all parties that we have such low turnout. I don't know what the answer is, but it's not right what we're doing right now.
And perhaps at least having conversations like these can help people understand the importance of having representatives who actually represent their views, right? Are you optimistic about democracy? You know, this is a show called Democracy Optimist, but you're in the super minority party, and I can hear some of the frustrations about what you weren't able to accomplish, perhaps, or some of the hurdles that you faced as a freshman Democratic legislator. So are you optimistic?
I weirdly am. I mean, that's the weird thing. Like, yes, I'm frustrated, but I think what we're seeing around the country right now is people realizing that they need to pay attention. And I hope that that translates into participation at the polls. But I think people are having to wake up as things are changing. I also see it with my daughter and your daughter and middle school and high school kids throughout Lexington. They're getting involved mm-hmm. and they're using their voices and getting their friends involved and they're paying attention. The kids are paying attention. Then we're going to be okay.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting that, you know, you hear conversations with you mentioned my daughter, who is very in tune with what's going on, you know, locally in the state and nationally. And perhaps it is our youth will save us. Keeping this out of partisan politics, what's one thing that listeners can do to support democracy?
I think finding your cause, whether that is through your church, whether that is on behalf of the library, or the school that your kids go to, it could be really anything, but getting involved in an organization that you care about and building up that community, whatever it looks like to you. I think ultimately we have all gotten into our silos and doing something to help other people and being a part of our larger community is what America is all about.
Anne Donworth is a member of the Kentucky House of Representatives, whose district includes Lexington. Anne, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
As a practical matter, can we claim to have a representative democracy when so few people are showing up to vote?
I think we can accept that kind of turnout and, you know, report as, you know, 18% was good because it was, you know, better than the statewide average. You know, that's in the primary that is very low turnout. It's a closed primary, so you have to be a registered member of the party. And in fact, independents are the largest growing number of voters in Kentucky, and they can't vote in either the Democratic or Republican primary. So I do think we need to look at the closed primary law here. But no, I think we cannot accept. And let me just bring it to the presidential election. You know, there are news stories after November 2024 touting the strong voter engagement. Two-thirds of the electorate, a little less, 64% turnout. A third, over a third of the people didn't show up. We can't celebrate that as strong, even if it was historically high, because so many people sat it out.
Home of the free. And the true. What does it mean? To be American.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interviews. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Have a question about something that you would like for us to look into? Record it on your phone and email it to es@eku.edu and add your name and town. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.